Today on the Best of Flashpoints, independent reporter Greg Pallas launches his Amazon to Arctic investigations of BP, even as the oil giant claims to have finally capped its deadly oil gusher. Human rights attorney Walter Riley on his false arrest in downtown Oakland after the verdict in the Oscar Grant case. And Flashpoints takes a look at Haiti 6 months after the quake. Stay tuned.
Joining us to talk about BP and, yes, expanding the investigation into BP, even as they're claiming it's time to go home and they're going to move on to their next devastation. The new investigation by BBC reporter, independent reporter Greg Pallas, is the amazing Amazon to Arctic investigation just beginning. And maybe you listening now can join and be a part of Greg's investigation. Greg Pallas, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Glad to be with you, Dennis.
Dentist, that's what my niece calls me, Dentist Bernstein, yes.
Well, you drill for the truth, so there you go.
And while BP drills to kill us all. First of all, let me just talk to you a little bit, Greg. We haven't spoken in a while. BP says they've done the deed. They've brought the cap down. The problem is over. Your thoughts as this thing unfolds?
Okay. Well, for those who don't know my background, obviously, you know, I'm a investigative reporter for BBC Television, and I, you know, written for Rolling Stone and others. But most important is that I used to be a fraud investigator, and I directed the investigation of frauds against in the Exxon Valdez grounding. And what I concluded was, while Exxon executives should have been hung by their heels, the real culprit in the Exxon spill was British Petroleum. They were in charge of, just like in the Gulf, of containing a spill, cleaning it up, stopping it from spreading. Same thing where they didn't have the equipment. They lied about having the equipment. They lied about having a plan. They lied about the danger of having the spiller in the first place in Alaska. They did it again in the Gulf. I've been following these guys for 20 years. And as you say, we've just, our team, the Pallas Investigative Team, just launched a new campaign, an investigative campaign, which takes us from the Amazon back up to the Arctic and Gulf. I mean, I've already been down to the Amazon looking at, you know, Chevron's destruction there in the rainforest. I've been many times into Alaska. And the reason we're going to Alaska is that's where BP is going next. Or that's, you know, people don't understand. BP controls the oil of Alaska. They own the Alaska pipeline. They own the, they run the shipping routes. They own most of the oil. To pay off their, the $20 billion that they're going to have to pay out, they're probably going to sell a chunk of their Alaska property. That will cover them because some of that's played out anyway. But we now, you know, Obama is opening up the Arctic offshore areas for drilling. Yes, he had a moratorium, but that's short term. And BP itself continues to drill under the Arctic Sea by drilling horizontally. So, interestingly, BP is one of the few companies which isn't covered by the offshore drilling ban or moratorium, because they go to the edge of the water. So technically they're on land. They drill down, then drill horizontally. But it creates some of the same problems, but they're exempt. In terms of BP capping the well, it's the oldest game in the book. You know, they keep punching you in the face and telling you how horrible it is. And then we're supposed to go hooray, hooray that they have capped it a month earlier than they said. Basically, every 3 days, they've dumped an Exxon Valdez worth into the Gulf. And they've been, every 3 days, and they've been doing that for 3 months. And, of course, they lie. We don't know what other problems there are. By the way, the reason, just so you know, the reason I usually announce my investigative reports, but a decision was made to do that, one, so if people want to donate and help out and go to gregpallas.com and participate, great. But it's also by actually going public with the investigation and saying, here's what we're doing. We've actually drawn a tremendous amount of whistleblowers from in the oil industry and within BP itself already. So, by the way, if you work for, I know that the Chevron's headquarters is within your listening area, hey, guys, give me a call. Now go to gregpalace.com. Seriously, it says contact Greg. We are really, we've got a lot of whistleblowers. We are always looking for more inside information.
You open up your announcement about this very public investigation, Amazon to Arctic investigation, by quoting an indigenous member of the Alaska community, and the quote is, "If I had a machine gun, I'd shoot every one of them white sons of bitches." Tell us about who this is and why he's so angry.
That was Henry McCarka, who is the leader of the Petitlik village, native village in Alaska. And Henry was there, was young, when the natives of Alaska, the Chugach, the Petitlik are part of the Chugach community. And the Chugach owned the Port of Valdez, which is the only place in the entire state of Alaska where you could have a terminus due to geologic reasons, an oil terminus. It was incredibly valuable, and the natives ended up selling it to British Petroleum's predecessor company there for a dollar to ARCO, which is part of British Petroleum. So they gave away this billion-dollar property for a dollar. But one of the things that they asked for, two things: jobs, because they wanted to work. And two, they said you had to keep their sound, because they're fishermen, keep the Prince William Sound pristine. It was part of the agreement. We'll give you your oil. They thought of it as patriotic. We're not going to hold up oil production for America, but we give us some jobs and keep it clean. And they had a list of specific things like the state-of-the-art radar, equipment to prevent a spill, and basically hiring the natives who know the sound to work with them in case of a spill.
Listen,
they lied about all of it.
Go on.
So they lied about all of it. And so McCarka, he's telling me about, they took the land for a dollar. They're stealing their properties even now. And then they destroyed these villages because these people live off of what they catch, you know, subsistence livers. And, you know, he's talking to me. He himself was in tears before he said that, because he was saying how he watched an otter claw its own eyes out because of the oil that got in its eyes. It was covered with oil, and it just literally ripped its own eyes out. And his view was, they set us up to take away our land and destroy it, and they knew it. And that's when he said if he had a machine gun, he'd take them out. In fact, if you go to gregpalace.com, you'll see McCarka. At that moment, I didn't realize that my BBC photographer is actually taking a still picture of him talking to me, but you see that angry look on his face when he's actually saying, I'll take a machine gun. He didn't say white SOBs. I think it's the term Munyok. He's an Aleutic language word for white guys. I had to make that little change in the quote because no one would know what the word in Aleutic.
Well, Greg, and what can you say about BP's responsibility for destruction of the Amazon? What has been their role there?
Well, I was there mainly looking at Chevron. We've now gone from BP being the green company, and they paint their gas stations green. They have solar panels on their cover, and environmental groups kept talking about how they were the good oil company, which I never believed because I saw the destruction that they committed in Alaska, continued in 2006, more destruction, and destruction all over the world. I mean, they were removed by the Russians, who are not known as great environmentalists, from a project in Sakhalin Island because they were destroying the whole place in the tundra. BP said, it was a way for Russia to steal our stuff. But come on, we know that they were destroying this place. In the case of the Amazon, the biggest the destruction was promoted mainly by Chevron's Texaco unit, but you also had Occidental Petroleum in there. You had a lot of these guys. In the case of BP in Latin America, they're main area of is that they kind of seized the oil of Colombia, and they basically hired the military as a kind of private security force, which in effect became you know, basically a murder squad. Anyone that got in the way of BP or raised their voice or had questions about the BP pipes to spoilage, who's getting the money, you know, the basically the hired killers would take care of dissent, and that's what BP was up to and has been up to in Colombia. In Kazakhstan, massive bribery. In fact, one of their oil company partners said, you know, he pulled out of a project because BP, with Exxon, just started bribing everyone with millions and millions of dollars, and he didn't want to be in a dirty project, you know, paying off the president of Kazakhstan. I'm getting whistleblowers, in fact, from the Caspian Sea, from inside the companies. I'm actually getting messages from oil platforms. We're getting some stunning, shocking material. So it's been very successful that way. And I'd like people to go to gregpalace.com and keep track of the information as we get it.
All right. And people can go to gregpalace.com and they can find out more information about however they want to join your investigation. We're speaking with Greg Palace, author of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, BBC reporter, independent reporter. We've been working with him over many years, reporting about various crucial issues of our time. We continue our discussion about what happened in terms of the verdict of the killer cop who shot a young man, Oscar Grant, in the back. And as far as I can see, and I've looked at that many times, premeditated murder. There was a couple of seconds he had a chance to think, figure out which gun he was going to use, and pull the trigger. It was an interesting response by the police, who turned Oakland into a ghost town, attempted to run people out of their buildings, and went after the peaceful protesters who were angry, militant, but exercising their constitutional rights. And they seemed to enjoy the looting of a few stores. They watched, they filmed, they circled, but they never went after the looters. Joining us to talk about this is Walter Riley, civil rights attorney, works closely with Danny Glover, works closely with the entire Haitian community, a respected member of this community, and somebody who found himself being put in handcuffs for standing in front of his offices in Oakland. Also there with him was Manuel Riley. He is also an Oakland resident and a family man watching it all go down after the verdict. I want to thank both of you for coming in and being with us on Flashpoints.
Thank you, Dennis.
Thank you.
And I was watching on Cron I was watching all the networks, all the coverage the night of the verdict, and I was watching and monitoring Cron. And I did see you, Walter Riley, arrested in handcuffs on Cron. And just so we're clear, I called up Henry Tannenbaum, who was taking the calls for Cron, and I reported that a respected civil rights attorney, human rights attorney, was arrested. Would they be reporting on it? First, we went back and forth about, was it really you? He was suggesting that maybe it was my perception of you. I want to confirm you were there, arrested.
It was me.
That was you, right?
And your perception was correct.
And did Cron report that a significant civil rights attorney was arrested? Did they report on Thursday night?
I'm not aware of it. I'm not aware that they made the report. I'm not aware that they made the report even early on Friday morning, but they certainly did not interview me.
They never spoke to you. They certainly had a lot to say about the dangerous looters in the Foot Locker store and broken glass and fires in garbage cans.
It meets a narrative that somebody wants. It meets a narrative that satisfies a certain kind of corporate media approach to what Oakland is. And it also, unfortunately, meets the narrative that it seems to me the police department would like to have of Oakland, because it helps to develop this idea that this is this crime-ridden place and that we have to give all the support and carte blanche to police departments. There's got to be another narrative developed about how we do things here in Oakland. One thing that's striking is that they stood there and watched the street. The Foot Locker windows being broken, and they watched as people went inside. They filmed it. It was yes, and there was a long line of police, wall to wall down the street from that could see it. And while there were people who were in orange vests trying to stop it, they didn't come to help them. But when they started to sweep, they were sweeping up all the people who were out there engaging in their right for civil protest and voicing their opinion. But they let the people who did the looting go through their lines. And they went further up Broadway, north on Broadway, through the police lines, because it's the only way you can get north on Broadway, was to go through the police line. And they set fires and did damage further up. Again, another way of promoting their narrative, their PR campaign. I say that they deliberately allowed it, and the question that we have to ask and is why they allowed it, and what was the purpose, and who benefited from that. The only benefit from that, allowing those folks to go further north, would be some propaganda campaign for the police department. We got to see it just like that.
They were the whole week. The police department was talking about losing 80 cops, being cut back. So here they demonstrated how important they were.
How important they were and how they are needed. And if they're arrested, where are those police officers going to? Where are they? I mean, to testify against folks. So they make those arguments. In addition to that, they got this tremendous amount of overtime for this. Whenever there is any civil action in the city of Oakland, they try and maintain that it's a case of people taking over the city, and they have to have as many cops on as possible. So they get lots of money being spent. But the whole area was completely cordoned off. Highway Patrol, federal police officers, local police officers from various departments, sheriff's departments, Antioch, in addition to everybody they could get from the Oakland Police Department on duty that night. They had the ability to stop that first attack on the windows at Foot Locker, and they didn't do it. Foot Locker probably will never do anything about it, but they should. But we as citizens of Oakland, we as people in this community, have to take that on. They also helped to develop the narrative of some outsiders, which is, I'm really concerned about this whole discussion.
I want to talk to you about the outside agitators, but just one moment. While it wasn't interesting to Cron and apparently important to Henry Tannenbaum that it be reported, or to his bosses, his supervisors, because after all, he's just a reporter taking calls. They didn't report it. It's very important to me and to the Pacifica Network, because the fact that they didn't report it, as you say, supported a certain narrative that everybody in Oakland was violent. If they put a significant civil rights attorney on the air to talk about being illegally arrested, at least the belief that you had that you were legally arrested, that makes there a bit of a debate about what exactly is going on. So let me start here before we get into the outside agitators, absolutely, which you apparently weren't. How were you arrested?
I was illegally arrested. There is no doubt about it.
How did that happen?
I had been out that night with a number of other people, as attorneys, a number of other attorneys in the crowd. We also wanted to voice our protests, our dislike for the verdict and the way things developed. People have different reasons. But I was also helping to monitor the crowd, and I was a legal observer. I was asked to be a legal observer. I was asked to be out there as part of one of the seniors in this community. And I think that a lot of young people out there give us a certain amount of respect because we are activists. A lot of us give us respect because they see us out there being part of the protests and the movement that they are part of, and that's dear to their part of their passions. At the time, I was actually physically manhandled. I was returning to my office, which is at 1440 Broadway, half a block down from 14th and Broadway, two doors from Foot Locker. I was returning to my office. The police were not at Foot Locker. They were not at the office when I was going into my door. And as I started into my door, I used the magnetic key entry, and they grabbed me. The line came down, and they grabbed me. My son was there and probably remembers more detail. I actually was worried about my son, Manuel, who is here. Who is a black man, young black man, the kind of black man that the police department will often react very violently to. And I was absolutely terrified that something terrible would happen to him because of the energy that these officers exerted. They were full pumped up. They were pumped up to do something. They were prepared to commit violence. We have to get to the bottom of it. But I was legally on the street at the time going into my office. I had been an observer going into my office. Dan Siegel was out there. Ann Wiles got hit by a police officer. Ann Wiles, who was out there as a legal observer, got hit by a police officer. And while she got hit, the person next to her, who was a young black man, got arrested and beaten and had to go to the hospital. I was in jail with him.
Why was he beaten and arrested by the police?
He was beaten and arrested because he had agreed with her that they were being too aggressive. This is long before the police had started to move down the street. Yes, several other people got hit. One Oakland teacher got hit and busted in the head and had to go to the hospital. A number of people who were in jail with me were people who were swept up, who were trying to get off the streets at the time. They got caught between lines of police officers, and not knowing how to get out and where to go, they got swept up. That's a big part of what happened that night.
That's the voice of Walter Riley, who was arrested Thursday night after the Messerly verdict, in which this killer cop was essentially let off scot-free. He could face as little as 2 years in jail. He could be out in 6 months. And they're going to fight gun enhancement. So it was a good reason for many people to be upset, to be already troubled by police behavior, so that this action by the police became that much more ugly. Manuel, you were there as your father was facing arrest as the beating of at the beating of that young man. What did you see going on?
Well, what's funny is my father being worried about me at the same time I was worried about him and the aggression that the police officers were putting on him. He skipped a couple of steps in that before they grabbed him, they definitely put the force of their billy club on him at least three times right in front of me, losing balance, totally unnecessary, right? So in the midst of him trying to get into his door, into his office, they decided that the correct response was to pop him with their billy club, knock him back, and as he's getting up, do it again and again, just before grabbing him and arresting him and choking him. And so...
And you were really trying to sort of restrain them from taking him away.
I was just trying to restrain them as well as help him keep his balance, of course. And as they were separating me from him is when they... there were just too many hands, too many officers. We're not fighting the officers. I'm not going to fight a whole line of officers. What we're trying to do is maintain some dignity and...
protect your dad.
Protect my father and, yeah, and... basically do what we have the right to do, which is to, one, in essence, we were complying with the order to clear the street, right? But that wasn't enough for these officers.
And we're not allowed to go into your dad's office.
Correct.
You were prevented in order to be arrested.
Yes.
But they didn't go after the footlocker. They went after a civil rights attorney and people who lived on the street.
Yeah.
Did you see this beating?
Of...
this young man?
I did not. Okay. I did not see the speeding.
All right. And what was going through your mind? Were you frightened? Did you think they were out of control? Was this sort of retaliation for just being there?
Honestly, I was caught off guard at the end of it. I wasn't surprised in terms of their response. I mean, what were we were already out there for something that was... completely unnecessary, which was the killing of Oscar Grant, handcuffed on his stomach. So for the reaction of professional black man or any citizen just exercising peacefully their right to gather, and their reaction of physical force was uncalled for and unsurprising. I've seen it. This is why KPFA is here, to be a voice for such actions. But I was scared for my father, of course. Definitely. Caught off guard and attacked by a mob of officers is not something you expect to necessarily walk away from. Especially if when you're just outnumbered.
Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, that is the voice of Manuel Riley. He's here with his dad, Walter Riley, significant member of this community, works with Danny Glover, a human rights activist, was in Haiti, to give you an idea of the kind of work that Walter Riley does, was in Haiti the day of the earthquake and spent the next several days risking his life to save other people's lives. Now, one of the things that was most disturbing to me, Walter Riley, and back to this Kron stuff, is you had these two women hosts cheering for more violence, cheering, looking for more violence. And these are, I'm wondering, for me, it was the disrespect to the family that they did no reporting about what happened. All they did is report about the footlocker. These are two women. I'm wondering how such people would feel, and Henry would feel, if they watched as their child was shot in the back in public. I wonder if they can imagine, if they can put themselves in the shoes of the Grant family and understand the tragedy. It didn't sound, from their report, like they could give a damn.
You know, it's not so surprising, Dennis, that there are members of them corporate media that has no sense of the struggles that people go through or feeling for what people are doing when they can define them as others. And that's what they do a lot with their lives. I didn't see this report, but it's not surprising that they would not have some sense of the tragedy that's involved for the family of Oscar Grant, or the feeling for someone who's lost in this tragic manner, or what it means for the community of Oakland in a real sense. So they can report on the footlocker, but not the tragedy of Oscar Grant and the verdict.
Now, we have a couple of minutes left, and I want to get back to that which you brought up earlier on, and that's this notion of outside agitators. What, from UC Berkeley? From the international community that makes up the Bay Area, outside agitators from where? You want to respond?
I don't know how people are going to defend themselves now that we are starting to talk about this in our community. But there were people on the air this weekend saying outside agitators or outsiders. They use the term outsiders quite often. I think it came from the mayor's office and some city council members, actually.
Police chief, too.
Yeah, the police chief. Outsiders. And they're hoping that that will run and that can get people to agree with. And obviously, if we don't challenge it, people will. We got to push back. But Berkeley is part of our community. And if we live in Oakland, we live in Berkeley. Or Berkeley, they're part of our jurors. They're just, you know, Richmond is part of our community. Lafayette is part of our community. What else is right? San Leandro, Hayward.
Where all the cops came from. All the outside agitator cops came from.
They came from Antioch. They came from all the places. But outsiders. San Francisco, this is a metropolitan area. It's a mecca for much of the world. And if people are here involved in their community where they live, even if it's only for a short period of time, we're going to have many people with addresses from many parts where hopefully that continues. Hopefully in every political activity we're engaged in, particularly something that has such universal appeal as civil rights violations, murder of people in our communities in this manner, that people from the world will be involved. We have asked people in Europe to participate in our campaigns for peace. We've asked people to participate in our campaigns against the death penalty, against campaigns against police brutality. We've asked people to come to demonstrations from all over the world. When we have a demonstration in Oakland around some political point that we want to make, some issues, whether it's local housing or something on a national level, we want people from the entire community to be involved, and that's the entire Bay Area. We live in a place where, as I said in my statement, there's a first-class, world-class community, a world-class college right here in Berkeley. We have world-class colleges in San Francisco and Stanford. These are the entire Bay Area, from San Jose up. That's our community, and we participate in each other's activity, whether it's social or cultural, certainly political. But in the Bay Area, we expect Berkeley, Oakland, Richmond, San Leandro, and Hayward to be involved in anything we have. And when our people representing elected positions call people from Berkeley outsiders, I find it outrageous. We will not in Oakland tolerate Berkeley people calling Oaklanders outsiders. And in Oakland, we cannot tolerate that either. We have to understand that we are part of this great community. And obviously, you do, most of the listeners here at KPFA, but then as listeners at KPFA have to search themselves and see how much they understand this. I'm told that there are many members of this KPFA greater audience that have some fears about going to Oakland. We have to confront that because Oakland, to some people, represents too black a town, somehow or another. We cannot allow that. And I want to push back against this outsider label and say, everybody in this community, confront that, talk about it, and deal with it. There's nothing outrageous about having to rethink what our feelings are towards one another or towards communities. The failure to rethink it is the problem. If we think about it, we will understand that we can't see each other as outsiders, that we're part of the same community, the same struggle. And this struggle around Oscar Grant is universal.
And just finally, we have 60 seconds left, Walter Riley, but, you know, it felt like our mayor in Oakland, Ron Dellums, was an outsider. I think perhaps he spent too much time in Washington, D.C. and forgot what it's like to really live in Oakland. But he said police did a great job. He was proud of the police and proud of the community. I guess he was proud of the police that arrested you. I guess you wouldn't say the police did a great job.
I would not say the police did a great job, not just in the way they arrested me, but the way they arrested a number of other people. And I wouldn't say the police did a great job in the way they had a plan for how to deal with the rally and the aftermath of the rally. That was not a great job and not great planning. If that was part of the chief's plan, then it's terrible. And it needs to be looked at. I want to have hearings. I want to look at that and see what their protocols were. Because if they had the protocols that allowed what happened at Foot Locker and us to move out, then they have to change it. As we cause changes in the police operations around the port demonstrations, there's got to be change. Thursday night was not what we want.
Legal action against the police department, against the city of Oakland?
Those things have to be considered. The people who are arrested are going to have to come together and think about how they respond to the criminal charges, but also what we deal with civilly. all of us in this community have to deal with it civilly. How the in the city council, call on the city council to do something more than say the police did a great job, because they did not do a great job.
All right, Walter Riley, Manuel Riley, I want to thank both of you for coming in and also for being out there and standing and watching and keeping an eye on the powers that be so that there wouldn't be another close-range murder of a young black man by out-of-control cops. Thanks for being with us.
I'm Kevin Pina, and you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Before we go live to Haiti, I'd like to take a few moments to reflect and comment on some of the related news I've read and heard the past few days. It's funny how Haiti was featured prominently in the mainstream news for about a month following the earthquake that struck last January, and then suddenly nothing. Gone from the news until this week, where today I read no less than four articles, all with the same headline, Haiti 6 months after the earthquake. Now, maybe that's a good thing, that Haiti's back in the news, but it also seems that many of today's so-called analysts, and there are exceptions, are willing to take on the difficult questions, such as the real miserable circumstances of the poor and homeless, where all the aid money is gone, and how can you rebuild Haiti based on the undemocratic behavior of the current president, René Préval? We all heard UN Secretary Ban Ki-moon and Chairman of the Relief Board Bill Clinton tell us several weeks ago that Haiti's recovery was dependent upon holding free and fair elections on November 28th of this year. Despite this, every Haitian living in the homeless camps knows that Préval has been anything but democratic and has actually worked to give an advantage to his own electoral team by excluding rivals in those upcoming elections. Préval has also actively directed a campaign to destroy Haiti's largest political party, the Lavalas Party, by buying off many in its leadership while keeping others behind bars in Haiti's dungeons. That's why it's so interesting that the narrative of those who represent themselves as representing Haiti, from media darlings to charities and celebrities, don't really say much about Haiti's current political reality and her history. I heard a rambling interview with Sean Penn yesterday, a man who holds the health and safety of thousands of Haitians in his hands, as he went on and on about the work he is doing in Haiti for the poor suffering victims of the quake. Not once did I hear any analysis of Haiti's political reality before or after the earthquake. Quite the contrary, it reflected much of what I hear from NGOs operating in Haiti these days, namely that the only Haitian history that matters began after the quake and usually on the very day they started working there. Maybe it's no accident that Penn had very little to say about Haitian political realities, given that he was also the recipient yesterday of Haiti's Order of the Chevalier, or Knight of the National Order of Honor and Merit, given to him by President René Préval in front of Haiti's crumbling National Palace. Apparently, one of Haiti's least popular presidents thinks Penn is doing a bang-up job along with several other NGOs in providing aid to those poor and helpless Haitians we're fed a steady diet of in the mainstream media. Préval also really liked the reporting of CNN, and specifically Anderson Cooper, who also stood along with Sean Penn as a shining example for the almost universally reviled René Préval. The truth is, not since the Peace Corps of the 60s and the 70s has there been a greater resume builder for a generation of the ambitious and adventurous who become overnight experts even if they don't speak the local language and lack any understanding of the history of their quote-unquote clients. But then, of course, that serves the interests of the powerful institutions with vested interests in Haiti who stand to benefit from the historical amnesia that dismisses the movement of the majority of the poor for social justice, due process, and sovereignty, that whitewashes any understanding of why Préval is so unpopular today and why he has worked so hard with millions of foreign dollars in his hands to destroy the Lavalas movement and keep former President Jean-Bertrand Aristide in exile in the Republic of South Africa. Just today, I also got another example of Préval's ineptitude and also his shameless corruption. We've heard that he has appointed Gerard-Emile Abi-Brun, who's the president of the powerful Nabatek Development Company, which is a consortium that's owned by some of Haiti's most powerful families. He appointed Mr. Brun the head of relocating all of the squatter camps in Port-au-Prince. So not surprisingly, Mr. Brunn, of course, is doing the first relocation on land that is owned by his own company, the Nabatech Development Corporation, which stands to reap an initial $7 million off of the deal. No surprise there. Joining us live from Port-au-Prince is Ansel Hirsch, who's been giving us almost daily updates on what's been going on the ground in Haiti. Welcome again to Flashpoints, Ansel.
Hi, Kevin. Thanks for having me again.
Now, of course, this issue of the forced relocation, in some instances of the more than 1.5 million people, you say 1.5 to 2 million people, who have been left homeless since the earthquake struck Haiti on January the 12th, 2010. The issue's heating up, and I understand that you've just broke some interesting news about who's overseeing the people who are responsible for relocating those victims.
Yeah, one of the main organizations really responsible for relocation as well as just monitoring of the over 1,000 camps in the Port-au-Prince area is the International Organization for Migration, which is a group that's a large organization that's very closely affiliated with the UN. It's often described as a UN agency, and they are a coordinating body really for a lot of the other private NGOs here in Haiti. They recently began a part of their operation called Camp Management. And what they have are many teams of four individuals who fan out across Port-au-Prince. And these individuals are charged with basically monitoring the situations in camps across the city and reporting back and making weekly reports. And those reports are actually available to anybody. They're viewable on a website called cmohaiti.wordpress.com. And myself and some other sort of progressive NGO workers, in my view, have been following these reports very closely. And the thing is that many of them are inaccurate. We've actually encountered these assessment teams on the ground, for example, at the Palais des Arts camp that's right here in Delma 33. This is a camp that was that is on private land, and over the past 2 months, really, they were dealing with constant threats from the landowner. It's about 100 families or so, and this is all detailed in one of the last stories that I wrote for Interpress Service, but this landowner was threatening to kick everybody out, and at one point he did start to take measures to really force people out of this area. He wanted to use the parking lot of his nightclub to host events, cultural events, and so he closed the gate to the camp and locked it so that people couldn't get out. Then he started rebuilding a collapsed wall around the camp, just basically imprisoning people inside and forcing them out if they wanted to try to exit the camp and get food or water. He tried to block NGOs from coming in and donating water to the camp. And really, a lot of the NGOs did not put up much resistance to that. And principal among them was the International Organization for Migration, which made a few visits to the camp. And finally, after weeks and weeks of these threats, including the landowner bashing in one of the tents of one of the individuals in the camp, actually the camp committee leader who was leading the resistance to this landowner's threats, finally, they negotiated with him, and now the people are able to stay on the camp, and the landowner hasn't been giving them further problems. But the interesting thing is that the IOM, the UN agency charged with monitoring these camps, made an internal report about what had happened, the results of these negotiations, and how they dealt with the situation of this landowner threat against the camp, and it totally misrepresented what happened. It referred to community mobilization of the camp residents, which simply never took place. The community mobilizer, a member of that team, the IOM's team, actually spoke English during negotiations in front of the camp committee. And so this camp committee couldn't follow what was happening. I was witness to that. You can actually see the presentation on my website, which is mediahacker.org, and I just dissect the way that it misrepresents totally what happened. Finally, just to give you a taste, at the end of the presentation, it lists next steps for dealing with how to support the camp residents of Palais des Arts. Again, this is 100 families. It talks about the installation of toilets and provision of new shelter materials, tarps, Since that presentation was given to other NGO workers and since those next steps were outlined, the residents of the Palais des Arts camp have received nothing. No toilets and no new tarps. And that's just one example.
So let me get this straight, though. We're dealing with a situation where we've got 1.5 to 2 million people homeless after the earthquake. They've been forced to not only squat on public land wherever they can find a place to sleep, but also on private land. And then you've got the International Office of Migration, which is sending out teams which are somehow mitigating somehow and following these negotiations with the owners of private land who are trying to get these people off of their land, to take their land back.
That's correct.
That's pretty much what we've got going on.
Yes, and the problem in my view is that it seems, at least in this case and also in other cases, that the internal reporting of the IOM to other NGO workers, and again, the IOM is coordinating, the International Organization for Migration is coordinating a lot of the work of private NGOs like Oxfam and others. Their internal reporting is just inaccurate. They don't talk, for example, in this case, about how part of the negotiation with the landowner that actually allowed the camp to stay in that area involved kicking out the president of the camp committee, a man named Ronald Jean, basically kicking him out into another camp. That was a demand of the landowner, and the IOM gave in to it. And so this individual was displaced for a second time since the earthquake. And in the presentation, it simply omits that. In its representation of what happened in the negotiations. So there are just convenient details, you know, being left out about further displacement and the concessions made to these landowners that really need to be known.
Well, listen, Ansel, we're going to have to leave it there, but thank you so much for your reporting. You stay safe. You've been doing an excellent job, and I want to tell you that we've gotten a lot of great feedback from our Flashpoint listeners about your work on the ground in Haiti and your reporting to us. Thanks, Ansel.
Okay, thank you, Kevin.
And now I want to go back to Port-au-Prince, Haiti, but this time I want to introduce Maurice Narcisse. Maurice Narcisse is the spokesperson for the exiled President Jean-Bertrand d'Aristide. Of course, we know he was overthrown February the 29th, 2004. As I'd said earlier in this broadcast, a lot of the non-governmental organizations, the United Nations and the international community, like to pretend as if Haiti did not begin her history until after the earthquake struck on January the 12th, 2004. It's convenient for them because it's convenient to fit their narrative while they try to reshape Haitian political culture and reality. Maurice Narcisse, welcome to Flashpoints.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for having me on Flashpoint.
Maurice, let's turn right away. People are, I think we see Bill Clinton, we see Sean Penn, we see a lot of people trying to avoid any discussion of what's really going on politically behind the scenes of what is this humanitarian disaster created by the earthquake. Give us your version of what's going on, really going on behind the scenes politically inside of your country today.
Yes, first of all, the situation is very difficult, the social situation. We still have 1.6 million people under the tent, you know, without any hope, without knowing when they will be able to live for a stable place, you know. Nothing has been, no communication, people under the tent don't know when they will be able to leave the tent. The people are living there with under bad conditions, sanitary conditions. And recently, we have had a lot of rain. And, you know, with the tent, it's very difficult. The government has made no communication, no clear communication on what will be done to displace to those people go toward more stable area. No communication also, we have no communication, no information on the reconstruction process, you know. People feel that they are frustrated. They feel that they are like out of anything in the country. They are out of the decision of the decision that are taken for the country. It's very, very, very difficult now.
Now, we know even before the earthquake that things were really bad. We also know and heard reports that President Preval was actively campaigning to basically destroy and dismember the Lavalas movement, the movement that represents the majority of the poor. Its leader, of course, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, is in exile following the coup of February 29, 2004. Many people also accuse Preval of continuing that program today, of trying to divide Lavalas. Where is Lavalas at in this process today? We know that they're going to be excluded, I hear, from the upcoming elections that have been announced for next November. Where is the movement of the majority of the poor today in this process?
Today, the government is trying, René Préval is still trying to keep Lavalas out of the electoral process in the country. People are determined now to fight for their right. Tomorrow we have a big protest. This is the occasion of the anniversary of President Jean-Bertrand Aristide, who is a symbol for Fermi Lavalas, a strong symbol for Fermi Lavalas, but not only for Fermi Lavalas, but for the fight of the Haitian people.
So tomorrow is former President Jean-Bertrand, his 57th birthday, right?
That's right. But people saw what happened. They said that the process that has been started before January, before the earthquake, will continue. And tomorrow, the president kept the electoral council, even though the political parties have been saying that this council has no credibility. No credibility is not independent. So recently, Fermi Lavalas has prepared a report to explain to the media, to the NGOs, to the international organization, why they are saying that this electoral council is not credible, is not independent.
Now, when we hear all this criticism of how aid hasn't reached people, and we know that President Preval's popularity has plummeted among the Haitian people, don't you think that it gives him credibility when stars like Sean Penn or media personalities like Anderson Cooper accept awards from him in front of the Crumble Presidential Palace? Doesn't that sort of lend more credibility to Preval in the midst of his plummeting popularity?
No, I think President Preval has lost his credibility here in this country. You know, we have had the election in 2008. There were like election with a very low participation. You know, the election that were like that was supposed to be done on February 28th. There was supposed to be also election that with exclusion of the majority. So now he wants to continue this process. But Fermi Lavalas has decided they are not going to be out of the process electoral. They are going to fight for their rights. They are going to defend their rights now.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. That is the voice of Maurice Narcisse, direct and live from Haiti. She is the spokesperson for former President Jean-Bertrand Aristide, who was overthrown in a coup on February 29, 2004, and currently resides in the Republic of South Africa in exile. Maurice, I just want to ask you again, you know, people have pretty much tried to write the epitaph of the Lavalas movement, have said that the Lavalas movement is dead, that its leadership is currently divided, that Preval has won that battle in the United Nations and the international community have won that battle. How do you answer them today?
I think if Fermi Lavalas, the only answer I can give, if Fermi Lavalas was really dead, what did they need to do so much to exclude Fermi Lavalas? I think this is the party of the majority. This is the party that is all over the country. Because they know that we are still a strong party, this is why they need to exclude Fermi Lavalas. If we are not if we are dead, I don't know what they need. I really don't understand what they need to do so much to exclude the party.
So they actually have pretty much they're going to go ahead with the next elections, November the 28th, and they are not going to change the rules of the game. Fami Lavalas, the largest political party in Haiti, is going to continue to be excluded from the electoral process. We've determined that.
I'm not sure that they are going to continue because the other parties, political parties, started to understand the situation. Because going to the election with a council, like electoral council, that is not credible, that is like not honest, that is not independent, they realize that they are not going to win, you know? They will be there only for the parade, you know? So now they started to say, no, we don't want to participate. There is a meeting tomorrow with the electoral council, and I think many political parties have already announced that they won't be part of this game.
So, in other words, they're just not going to participate, and that might call into question the credibility of the entire process.
That's right.
So, where do you go from here? Where does the Lavalas movement go from here at this point? You're going to continue to take to the streets, obviously, tomorrow. You've announced that there's going to be a demonstration July the 15th,
yes,
which is the 15th, the anniversary of Aristide, his 57th birthday.
We want to keep the mobilization going on until people are ready here.
Now, of course, you know, none of the non-governmental organizations, none of the aid groups or relief organizations that are working on the ground talk at all about this history that you're giving us of electoral exclusion in Haiti. It's almost as if history began after the earthquake. Why do you think? Do you think that there's a benefit for them in the international community by pretending that Haitian history only began after the earthquake?
No, I think it's totally false, you know. Haitian history didn't start after the earthquake. It's true that we have, for 200 years, we have had a lot of social exclusion, political exclusion. When the Lavalas government came, they tried to change something, you know. We have the coup d'etat two times, you know. And now, I don't think that we can say that the story of Haiti is starting now. Because if it's starting now, it's starting without the people.
So we can pretty much understand that today those interests of the majority of the poor, which Lavalas has represented, remain intact. And certainly, the majority of the people who've been affected by this crisis, by the earthquake, are most of them Lavalas who are living in the camps?
They are mostly Lavalas, those that are living in the camp. And I'm telling you, we have visited many camps. It's very, very, this is unacceptable. Those are not conditions where human people must be living.
I want to thank you so much. That's the voice of Maryse Narcisse, who joined us live from Port-au-Prince, Haiti. She is the spokesperson for former President Jean-Bertrand Aristide, who was overthrown in a coup February 29, 2004, and remains living in exile in the Republic of South Africa. Maryse, thank you so very much for joining us today on Flashpoints.
Thank you, Kevin.
It's been a pleasure. I also want to thank Ansel Hirst again. This has been Flashpoints. Tune in tomorrow.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein with Jesse Strauss and Eric Klein. Miguel Molino is our roving producer, and JR and the Block Report contribute to this program. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera. To comment on today's program, please contact us at dbernstein@igc.org. Look us up on the web at flashpoints.net for our archive shows, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/flashpointsnews. Dozens of affiliate stations across the country broadcast Flashpoints on a regular basis. Please email us your call letters and Flashpoints broadcast scheduling to dbernstein@igc.org, and we'll add you to our website. Thank you for listening.